Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to revisit a conversation that we had some time ago with Ross Jaffe. Ross is a physician by training, and he practiced medicine. He went into the venture capital world. He was recognized on the Forbes Midas list of leading venture capitalists. He has worked with numerous companies and leaders and has served on a number of boards. And he has some great insights around leadership and lessons learned in his career, as well as watching the careers of many executives. And he's got some great thoughts to share. Looking forward to our conversation with Ross. We're very happy to have with us Ross Jaffe. And Ross, I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your overview of your career, your story?
Yeah, I'd be glad to, Mark. And it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate your inviting me. I'm a physician by training, actually. I was pre-med in college but had real interest in public policy, and so merged those two by focusing on health policy in the late 70s when it wasn't such a hot topic as it is now. After a little stint working in Washington for a health policy consulting firm, I went to med school at Johns Hopkins, and then got the idea that I also wanted to get a business degree at some point, but I actually put that off until after my residency. I came out to San Francisco to do my residency at UC San Francisco in the height of the AIDS epidemic, which was a really interesting place to train, one of the prior pandemics. And then I, after residency, went down to business school. And I really thought I'd come out and be doing something in the healthcare world, health policy, healthcare administration. But by accident, I ended up in the venture capital industry as one of the first physicians. I got a call when I was in business school. A VC firm had gotten my name from one of my professors. It was a time when healthcare investing was really taking off here in the Valley in 1990. And they were looking for someone with a healthcare background to help the generalists in venture capital who were trying to do more and more healthcare. And so it was just, you know, it's life. A lot of life is it's better to be lucky than smart. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time to be one of the early physicians in the industry. That was with a firm called Brentwood Venture Capital, where I became a partner a few years later. And then in the late 90s, the height of the internet boom, a lot of firms who were doing both IT and healthcare decided healthcare was the old economy, and you know, the internet was the new economy. They only wanted to focus on the internet. So several of us spun out of Brentwood and merged with other healthcare people from two other firms to form Versant Ventures, which is now one of the larger healthcare-focused venture capital firms here in the U.S. And so I've really been doing venture investing for the last 30 years. My area, well, I've done investing in biotech and healthcare service, healthcare IT. I really focused on medical technology, and have been doing that up until about 4 or 5 years ago when I stepped back from active investing to pursue some other activities.
One of the questions I like to ask each of our guests is, if knowing what you know now, if you were able to spend back time and talk to a 22-year-old Ross, what advice would you give him?
Well, the first thing I'd probably tell him is be less anxious. I was always worried, you know, I always worried about making sure I performed well, and I realized I spent so much of my life more stressed than I really need to be, that if I had just worked hard and used my abilities, I would be fine, as I turned out to be. So I joked that in my mid to late 40s, I started losing my anxiety drive, you know, which I think drives a lot of us. I think anxiety drives a lot of high performance. You know, wish I had had a little less anxiety, could have enjoyed life a little bit more. But other than that, I think I've really had an incredibly fortunate career. And like I said, it's always better to be lucky than smart. And I've been fortunate to have a lot of good luck.
Is there any advice that you received back when you were younger that you wish you would have ignored?
Um, not really that I wish I had ignored. I got some good advice. One of my early mentors, the man who, one of the people who hired me into Brentwood, used to say that so much of life is knowing what not to do and what not to focus on so you can focus on the more important things. And I wish I had heeded that a little bit more, because I think sometimes I focus on things I didn't need to be doing. But, you know, figuring out what's really important and knowing what you don't have to do, you let others do, trusting others to do things, I think is really important. You don't have to do it all yourself. And so that would, you know, that would be something. And the other thing, learning to be a really good team member. It's hard in venture capital because you're really, I joke that while companies are like baseball teams where everybody plays a different position and you have, you know, a general manager who the CEO is trying to make everybody perform well, venture capital traditionally has been more like tennis teams where everybody plays singles and adds up the score at the end of the day. And I don't think it traditionally promotes great team behavior. And I think in the end, what you really need for organizations like venture capital firms that have where you're, you know, you've got to lead a deal, you've got to be the board member. It's really learning to play more like basketball teams where you, you know, you try to help get the ball to the right person to score in that situation. And sometimes it's you and sometimes it's other people, but you've got to, you know, help your teammates be successful. And that's really the goal. And it took, you know, there was no, when I was coming through, there was no playbook, but I think that's really a approach we tried to take at Versant. I'm doing some work for NEA. I think they do a very good job on that, of really trying to help everybody be successful at what you do.
So you've done a lot of work with helping companies as they're getting set up and started, and you've hired a lot of people over the years as far as of looking at CEOs as well as senior leadership teams. Maybe somebody that, you know, is doing this for the first time, or, you know, maybe new in that that seat where they're having to put together a team. What are some things that you look for as you're hiring people?
You know, it's interesting. You know, most people focus on, you know, experience in the role, you know, role experience, and then domain expertise, which is knowing the, you know, the area that the company is playing in very well. And so, and I think both of those things are important. And you vet that by looking at people's experience, their career, how they've come up. And clearly that role experience, having, you know, knowing that they can take on and know what to do in that role. And also the domain expertise, the more they know about the specific area they're playing in, the better they're going to be. But the one area that often I don't think gets enough attention is judgment. And judgment is really how you make decisions in the face of uncertainty. You know, if the answer is clear, that doesn't involve any judgment. But when the answers are unclear, knowing how to get to the right answer or a good answer for the organization is really, really critical. And good judgment is something that can't be taught, but you have to learn and you have to develop. And I think people often focus on their knowledge and of a role or knowledge of a field and don't think about, am I making good decisions? How do I make good decisions? And so when I interview someone, I'm not only looking for that role and domain knowledge, I'm really trying to probe on situations where they've either had a lot of uncertainty or been thrown a curveball. And how did they handle those situations and how did they react and respond? So much of building these small companies, I joke that in a small company, there are 1,000 ways they can fail and a very few ways they succeed. And there are 1,000 little things that come up that you've got to make judgments about in every role, particularly the CEO role. And so to probe on people how to do that, when things, you know, there are these random events that come up, and when they cut our way, you call them good luck. And when they cut against you, you call them bad luck. But really whether they're good or bad is sort of how you react to them and what you make of them. And when I, you know, I've seen CEOs who are very, have good judgment, have a, you know, a random event happen, a curveball thrown at them, and they figure out how to wall it off and deal with it and not have it derail the organization, where I've seen lesser CEOs, poor judgment, wallow in that and have it really take the company down. Similarly, I've seen opportunities arise when the company's going down one path and something comes up, the really good CEOs will see the opportunity of that and pivot, where I've other seen other groups just keep plowing on the direction they're doing and not recognizing the opportunity before them. So this issue of judgment, it's a hard thing to judge, judgment. It's a hard thing to determine. But I think that people demonstrate during the course of their career, when confronted with situations, how they react and respond. And so those are, that's really something that I probe for and try to understand. And then the other last thing, of course, in addition to ability to do the role and domain judgment, it's just how they work with other people. You know, life's too short to deal with difficult people. People want to work in environments where they feel like they're respected and treated with respect. And so you want to have people who have good interpersonal skills, I think, in those roles as well.
So talk a little bit about maybe in your own experience, when you talk about judgment and having clarity, when the wheels have fallen off, are there some questions that you kind of ask yourself as you're trying to sort out kind of a situation where things haven't gone, you've gotten a curveball? What are some things that you've done as far as to kind of get clarity?
Well, one of the things is how you sort of initially react to things. And some people are much more reactive and emotional. I tend to sort of say, okay, I'm having this reaction. Let me quell it and sit back and think. There's a famous novel in medical circles called The House of God. It was written in the early 70s about internship at Mass General, one of the hospitals in Boston. And there are these rules of the House of God. And I've never forgotten rule 3 of the House of God, which is the first thing you do at a code is take your own pulse. And I think that's true in all these situations. When a situation, surprises you or suddenly gets really difficult, the first thing you do is sort of assess where you are and calm yourself down and start focusing and not just reacting. And then you've got to figure that I also have the analogy that most of life is like golf. You've got to play the ball where it lies. You can be upset about how you got there, but that doesn't matter at this point. What really matters is what do I do from this point going forward to get myself into the best situation I can be to make the best out of this. And it may be that there's nothing good you can do. There may be nothing you can fix. But you just have to do the best you can. I encountered this a lot in my residency training during the AIDS epidemic when we didn't have any therapies really yet. And, patients had a bad disease and you as a doctor couldn't fix them. So the question is, how did you help them deal with the remainder of their lives as gracefully as possible? And I think you've got to decide in every situation what the real options are and then make the best judgment you can about them and go forth with that and not continually second guess yourself. So, it's that calmness. It's really trying to assess what the real options are, what the practical options are, and then making decisions, say, okay, we're going forward with this and we'll deal with the consequences and do the best we can.
What are some of the mistakes that you see maybe first time CEO make? Is there a kind of a pattern that you've seen as far as for those that are listening to this podcast, a number of them are maybe in that first CEO role or they're maybe a little bit later in their career, but anything that you've seen as a pattern that people need to be aware of?
Well, one is, when you're in your first CEO role, you often feel you've got to prove yourself. And in doing that, you have to feel like you're the one who has to solve all the solutions and that somehow asking for help is a sign of weakness. Hmm. And I view the ability to ask for help, to take in other thoughts as a sign of security. It's insecure people have trouble doing that. Secure people have no problem asking other people for their thoughts or their help and admitting what they know and don't know. And so, from my mind, and looking at and thinking about some other situations, this insecurity, this sense that I've got to fix it, I don't want to show that I don't know the answer here, is really a bad reaction. Some of the best CEOs I know ask other people a lot for their thoughts and their help. But then they know they've got to make a decision, and they're very clear that they're going to make the decision, they're going to go forward and deal with this. They really want to get that diversity of opinion. And that's the other aspect of it. It helps to have a diversity of perspectives on things. It's rare. I always joke that we're all victims of our own experience. You know, we all see the world from where we've come. And sometimes it's very helpful to see things from other people's perspectives that gives you a broader perspective, help you come to a better overall solution. And that's the value of diversity in boardrooms. That's the value of diversity in teams. And again, to get the most out of that diversity, you have to be very secure about who you are, and then and create an environment of trust so those other people will share their perspectives, and collectively you'll come up with a better answer. And so in my mind, that need to feel like you've got to do it yourself, not to sort of bring in the team, not to be able to share, that's really a challenge I've seen for first-time CEOs.
You mentioned about working with the board, and that's one of the probably the adjustment that somebody moving from a role, maybe they were CFO or another functional role, and all of a sudden now they're reporting to the board or working with the board. What advice would you give? You've been a board member on numerous boards, as well as have seen different leaders in those situations, but anything that you would give as far as advice working with boards?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. A lot of people are used to managing up to one person, right? They're used to managing up to the person they report to. And all of a sudden you go into a boardroom and you've got 5 to 7 to 9, 10, people that are your quote unquote reporting to, but they're not directly there every day. And they're not engaged in the way that your manager usually is, who's in the business all the time. So it takes extra effort and it takes extra, thought to figure out how to get the best out of your board. But you've got to view your board as another resource for success, not as a weight around your neck that you've just got to keep up. And I've seen the worst situations where the CEO, acts like the board is just another pain in the ass he has to deal with, or he/she has to deal with, as opposed to a situation in which you can get value out of your board. And the CEO needs to strategically think about the board and work with the leading board members, whoever they are, to make sure they get the right people around the table. In many situations, you're going to have a bunch of investors around the table because they've basically put their money in the company and they want to be involved. And so you've got to, deal with that. And there are often different personalities, but you've got to try to figure out how to get the best out of each of them. And then the important thing that I think often gets short shrift is how you bring on the board really good independent people who are going to give you good perspective, bring really good expertise or domain knowledge to the table, and are people who you can get value out of in trying to, deal with these 1,000 issues that are come up as you run your company. Mm-hmm. And I think thinking strategically and thinking about the board as a resource and something you need to think out and get the most out of is really the right mindset, as opposed to thinking about as a burden.
So we're living kind of in some unusual times with everybody. We talked a little bit before we started the podcast that everybody's kind of in the same boat dealing with COVID and everything that's going on in our world. What advice would you give leaders that as they're kind of, again, going back to that uncertainty aspect of it, any advice that you'd give somebody leading during this time?
Well, coming back to what I talked about before, COVID is just a random event, right? It's something you would have never expected and very few people would have expected, and was something that was hard to plan for because we've never seen even in other pandemics, we've never seen something that has such a widespread effect for which we've had to, really restrict people's activities. But this, like anything else, in every problem, there are usually opportunities as well, and usually opportunities for change, because there's a certain inertia we all get in what we're doing that sometimes it takes a shock to the system to force you to rethink. And I've seen even the portfolio companies, I'm on 8 boards right now, and they have a 9th company that I've co-founded. And I've seen in several of them where coming out of COVID, I think we're going to be much stronger companies. Because of changes, because of rethinking we've had to do. We've had to examine every aspect of the business. We've got to figure out where every dollar is being spent. We've got to figure out what every role is. And there are some new, you know, efficiencies that have come out of it. There's some new thinkings about how can we access customers more efficiently now that we can't meet with them on a regular basis. I think the use of, you know, clearly in medicine, the use of telehealth is here to stay. I think in business, the use of teleconferencing like we're doing now is here to stay in ways that it wouldn't have been but for this epidemic. So, and it is really these types of challenges that really prove, you know, test teams, but really prove who's got the chops to really create, you know, go through the businesses. So it tells you a lot about your people and how they respond. And so I think there are real opportunities in this when you look for it. Now, there's some businesses, I've got one that I'm doubtful is going to survive, you know, just because of, you know, the impact on its business. There's several others who adapted early. I think the companies that reacted the earliest and really made hard choices early are really doing the best now. Mm-hmm. And those companies that delayed and tried to deny that it was going to be as big a deal as it was are ones that are in more trouble. Fortunately, I don't have any of those because I was really on them about, you know, how important this was, both from my medical point of view as well as my business point of view. But I do think that, you know, for all the challenges, there's some really interesting changes in business and positive changes in business that are going to occur coming out of this epidemic.
So you have your hand on the pulse of, as a doctor, that's a terrible pun, but you know what's going on in healthcare. But what's exciting you about kind of as you look out on the horizon with healthcare and what's going on? Any trends that you think are going to be definitely impactful as far as in that area?
You know, when I was more actively investing, whenever anybody would ask me about that, it reminded me of skiing on a powder day. and I had this instructor friend, and he and I would go out skiing on a powder day. And because he had the red jacket on as an instructor, people would come up to me and say, oh, where should we go? And he'd always be pointing where we had been because he didn't want to give up the fresh powder that we were going to hunt, that we were on the hunt to find. So you have to be suspicious when you ask a VC that question if they're going to tell you really where to focus. But you know, I can be a little more open about it now. Look, it is a phenomenal time in medicine and healthcare in general, and I think you know you can look in every aspect. You know, the science and the evolution of science is phenomenal. We're seeing that play out in the biotech industry in this really long, sustained up market that we've had in both the public and the private markets is really based on the fact that just so much potential to really continue to make a great difference in health in medicine through the biopharma side. On the med tech side, you know, some of the areas, you know, the challenge in med tech is you sort of solve one problem with a set of tools. There aren't as, you know, the problems to solve get narrower and narrower. But I do think there are real opportunities, especially as we gain more insight into physiology. I have a hierarchy of opportunity in medtech that I talk about where, you know, the best opportunities are when somebody comes up with just a, you know, a new area of using a device that we've never thought of before. And there are areas out there like I think some of the neurostim stuff and using Set Point Medical is a good example where you're and I'm not involved in that company. I'm just very impressed how they can modulate the vagus nerve and use that to modulate the immune system. I mean, that's, you know, it's a device acting as a drug. Mm-hmm. Even in areas where we have existing technology, when there's a new insight in physiology, you can often open up new areas as we've done in renal denervation for hypertension. And then even within places where you've got, you know, no new insights in physiology is existing, just some careful thinking about how to do better ways of doing the same procedure is another area. And then, of course, there are new materials and new manufacturing techniques that allow us to take existing technology and make it better and better and better. And then the final area is that whenever the government changes regulations and or whenever the environment of healthcare changes, there are new opportunities. And I think we're going to see that play out in home, you know, the shift to more telehealth, the more shift to more home management is going to create a bunch of opportunities for devices and technology that are really suited to managing patients in the home. So you've got that, you know, you've got the sciences trends, you've got the, you know, what's going on in medtech trends. And then in the health service delivery, you know, there's just going to be a constant move to move patients to the least costly setting with the least skilled provider to try to save money. And that creates opportunity for very innovative new models, and particularly models for managing chronic disease. We've done a great job over the last 30 years of really improving the treatment of acute disease. But it's these management of chronic disease, the diabetes, the hypertension, Alzheimer's, you know, arthritis, those areas that are really going to, I think, help improve healthcare costs as well as quality of life for the patients. So I see a target-rich environment out there. Doesn't mean any of it's easy, because it takes time and a lot of money to build these businesses. But there are a lot of opportunities out there.
Great. As you are talking with leaders, are there any books that you recommend for leaders that you're talking to, or some that are your favorite that you'd recommend to somebody to read?
You know, interesting. I'm not a big fan of a lot of business books, because I think so many people develop a hypothesis about something and then search around for the data to support the hypothesis and ignore the data that doesn't. So I look at some of the, I read some of these occasional business book, and I don't find it helpful. The one that I think is just everybody in a leadership role should read is Good to Great by Jim Collins. It's a, you know, it's been around for 20 plus years now, but it's just such a thoughtful piece. And it's based on really empirical research about really looking at what drives very successful companies. And his discussion of a level five leader and what that's about, his discussion of the Stockdale paradox of, you know, the difference between optimism and long-term confidence, I think is really, so there's some valuable concepts in that book, The Flywheel Effect. It's a really excellent book. The other book that I found helpful, it's not really a business book, but I am always fascinated by how people think. And one of my areas of real interest these days is what's going on in neuroscience. And there's, you know, the classic in that area is Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman, who did all the work. He and Amos Tversky did so much of the important psychology work to really elucidate how we think. And it's, we have these two systems, you know, the intuitive mind that reacts very quickly, which is where we focus most of our time. And then this rational override that we have that can be a rational override or just a rationalization for our intuitive mind. But understanding how the brain works is just, I think, so helpful to understanding people and how they behave. And, you know, if you want a quick version of that, you can read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, which is sort of built on the same concepts. But that's the second one. And then the other book that I'm fascinated by, particularly in the current times where there's so much political division in the country, is a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Differ on Religion and Politics by a guy named Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And he builds on the Thinking Fast and Slow work with some additional work research that he's done in social psychology, talking about what the real origins are of conservatism versus liberalism and how they're not rational things. These are sort of hardwired, embedded, or at least embedded reactions we have to things. And once you understand that and you can bring your rational mind to really looking at these things, a lot of those divisions, I think, can be knocked down. So those are three very different books, but things that have just sort of shaped my frame of how I think about the world.
Yeah, we're always looking for suggestions and definitely appreciate that. What, outside of work, what do you do to kind of recharge?
Well, I certainly hang out with my wife, and my kids are grown, but we try to interact with, you know, see them as much as we can. Well, it's been hard in the pandemic. We're doing a video conference. But I've always, you know, I try to work out and stay in great shape. I think the older you get, the harder you have to work to stay where you were. And I think it's really important, though, to you know, stay in shape and watch what you eat, you know, as you get older. I play a lot of tennis in my life. I've skied a lot. For a number of years now, I've been racing cars. Huh? And although I haven't been able to be in a race car in the last year or so because of a health issue, I really love that. I always joke that I can't really relax unless I'm doing something life-threatening. What I mean by that is that, you know, being a venture capitalist where you're involved, you know, you're spread really wide on a lot of different issues. It's really hard to turn the mind off. And there's always something that you can be thinking about and focused on and worrying about. And I found even in my tennis as I got older, it was just harder to concentrate between, you know, keep the concentration up between points because I start thinking about the kids or work or something else. But I find when I'm skiing down a ski slope or racing on a racetrack that I got to be totally in the moment. And that's some ways relaxing. So, it seems counterintuitive, but I think those, you know, stressful sports are sometimes more relaxing in a weird way.
So what kind of car do you drive? What is your...
My daily driver or my race car?
No, your race driver.
I've raced open wheel cars for about a decade in the Skip Barber Racing School.
Okay.
But then I shifted over into sports cars and have been racing mainly Lotuses, which are a British sports car. I've raced a Lotus Elise for a number of years, and my current car is a Lotus Evora, two-seater British sports cars. Okay. That are incredible handling cars and really fun to drive.
Cool. Very cool. Any parting advice that you give somebody as they're in their career? What advice would you give?
Well, the only thing I would say is that, you know, I look back and I realize your career is really a marathon, not a sprint. And you've got periods of very intense work along the way. But you should pick up your head every once in a while and sort of think, you know, where am I going? Where do I want to be spending my time? The older I've gotten, and now that I'm, you know, in my early 60s, I am really focused on something I call QTR, which is quality time remaining. You know, you start to realize that whereas when you're really young, it seems like a long time, it really does go by quickly. And you know, your kids grow up more quickly than you expect. You age more quickly than you expect, and you want to make sure you're enjoying life along the way, as well as really thinking about what's important to you over the long term. And it's easy to get caught up in just focusing on making money. It's more important to think about how do I make enough money so I can do the things I want to be doing to be happy. I think you don't want to lose that perspective.
Good stuff. I appreciate you taking some time out, Ross, and definitely wish you continued success with all you're doing. And it's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Mark, and good luck, and thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.